Hello, I'm Bill Curtis, and you're listening to KBOO.
Hello, and welcome to the Radio Zine on KBOO. I'm SW Conser, and today we're talking with a newscaster and documentary producer whose career has spanned 50 years. His work has been awarded numerous Emmy and Peabody Awards over the years, and he's recently gained pop culture status as the voice of a radio news quiz. Bill Curtis, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much. You were referring to the NPR show, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and that's why I'm in town.
That's right. And, you know, just a few short weeks ago, we had the honor of hosting Frederick Wiseman.
Yes,
now, 50 years ago, yeah, he was a practicing lawyer in Connecticut who became disillusioned and decided to make documentaries instead, and he's still doing that today. 50 years ago, you were a young lawyer in Kansas who had an itch to go into broadcasting, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Yes. Well, by the time I got out of law school in 1966, I had 10 years. Yet everybody starts, you know, as young as they can. I was 16, a little 250-watter in Independence, Kansas. Then I went on to KU, Kansas University, and then to law school. And a strange thing happened to me on the way to the law. I was studying for the bar, and the news director at the only television station in town asked me to fill in for him at 6 o'clock. So I went out, did the 6 o'clock news, and we had a cold front that was coming in and touching off some high winds and maybe some tornadoes. So at 7 o'clock, I went on the air, and we had one of our cameramen out at the southwest edge of the city who saw a tornado.
And this is in Topeka.
In Topeka, Kansas. And he said it's headed for the city. It's now in the country. You never think it's going to happen to you. So we waited and went on live, and we were giving the warning, watch, I guess. And then all of a sudden, about 5 minutes later, he wrote in a note to kind of get through the veil, you know, of noise of everybody rushing in and panicking. And it said, it's just wiped out. 200 luxury apartments just been built. And I put the two location points together, and sure enough, it was headed for the Capitol building. 150,000 people at the time. I was living in married housing with my wife and six-month-old. And between us, state hospital, shopping, you know, the whole bit. And so I went on the air and said, for God's sake, take cover. I mentioned that phrase
mainly
because
to your family.
It is almost carved in the Capitol building. They just held a 50-year thank you in Topeka. It was really sweet, and I went back for a speech sponsored by the newspaper there. You know, that's a change in their life, certainly in mine. And I said, okay, to hell with the law. I'm going to stay in broadcasting, and set my tape out, as we all do. And it seemed like God was kicking me out of town like Dorothy, but guiding me at the same time, and wound up with CBS and a 30-year career.
Right. From Kansas, you moved to Chicago right before the Democratic Convention, landed there in 1968. Mm-hmm. You covered the Chicago 7 trial. Your law background must have come in handy there.
Very, very.
And then you went to L.A. just in time for the Manson family trial. I mean, you covered the fall of Saigon in 1975. It's like you had an internal compass. Okay, history is about to land over here. Let's go.
Timing is everything. And I happen to be there when the tornado comes in and these other big events. My law degree and past the bar really came in handy. You know, Angela Davis, Juan Corona,
right.
They were big headlines at the time. I stayed in the Manson trial for 10 months right next to Charlie and, you know, went on the air to tell the world that he was found guilty and the three girls. And then eventually in 73 went back to Chicago, picked up my anchor duties again, did some investigative work, broke the Agent Orange story for one thing. And have been at it. And then, after 30 years, retired from CBS and went back to start my own documentary company. Not everybody wants to do it, but not many people are able to put the pieces of the puzzle together. You have to have a business acumen and a desire. You have to raise money, produce your product, and sell it. And I just found that interesting. So at this juncture, I have narrated 1,000 documentaries.
Wow.
Produced 500 out of Curtis Productions. Series like Cold Case Files, American Justice, Investigative Reports. Now we do American Greed for CNBC. All of them were 100-show series. And we're still cranking on American Greed.
Well, you're talking about timing. I mean, 50 years ago, this was really the dawn of mobile camera equipment and direct cinema. We were talking about Frederick Wiseman, Albert Maysles. These fellows were going around with the first portable cameras that didn't need a tripod. They had a microphone on them. And that really just opened things up. I mean, you mentioned that you did a documentary based on a news investigation about Agent Orange, the defoliant that was sprayed in Vietnam. And this ended up being screened in Washington, D.C., and the Veterans Administration ended up compensating the vets who were suffering from the effects.
By now, you know, we're 20 years or more, 25 down from the time we broke it in 78. 200,000 veterans have been compensated. 50 diseases have been recognized. I think back, we were a local station, and the Veterans Administration treated us as such. Oh, this can't be a big story. The networks would have it. It's just a local station. But I had, you know, everybody needs a whistleblower inside. And there was a representative of veterans who put it together names of guys with symptoms that really couldn't be explained. But she had seen a piece I had done on Agent Orange and the defoliant, and kind of put two and two together, so she sent them to me, and I started the legwork to interview these individuals. And when we went on the air, it was quite shocking, of course, to the VA, because the veterans picked it up. This is 5 years after the fall of Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
They were being called baby killers. They were having a terrible time. No homecoming parades. They couldn't wear their uniforms back to the neighborhoods because people were so upset with the Vietnam War. And the anti-war movement was still going on. And it ran. It was a local, but what they did was they took a 3/4-inch cassette and they sent it around to all the veterans organizations. So now the pressure is coming on the politicians. So we get an invitation from House Armed Services Committee. We go back, and they want to see it. So we walk into the hearing room, and it was jammed. People standing around, the staffs from all the veterans organizations. Everybody wanted to see it. It had not been on network. So we ran it. And about 10 minutes in, there is a sequence where we zoom into the little finger of a 5-year-old boy who came and stood by his father, who was telling of his problems. And it just hung by the skin, a congenital birth defect. And as it zooms in, it's quite dramatic. And I could hear a hush and a breath being taken by everyone in the room, like, my God, it's true. We chemically distributed this poison on our own men, and we didn't know. What happened was, it had 40 years of being used by farmers. They had all the research, and there were big letters on the side of this defoliant, 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T, said absolutely safe to humans. And it was used as prescribed in the agriculture. But it proved so effective in Vietnam, it actually started in 68, 70, 71, that the military sends back to the big five chemical companies that were manufacturing it, said, we want more. Well, there was an engineer down in the bowels of the chemical companies that said, you know, we produce not only Agent Orange, which was a defoliant, but A byproduct of that is dioxin, which is the most toxic substance made by man.
Right.
And if we heat more of this product, which we would have to do to meet the volume, we're going to produce more of it. So the product we're going to be sending over there is literally a weapons grade, no longer innocent to the use on humans. This may be a problem. So off it goes, and usually it's a hormonal base that causes leaves to fall off the trees, but in 2 weeks they go through their growth cycle. I had GIs telling me they were walking patrol, and there would be a spray, and they would watch the leaves fall off in 2 hours.
My.
So this was bad stuff. And we started with soft tissue sarcomas and began to link it to a number of diseases. 50, as a matter of fact. That's the story of Agent Orange, but wow. It was also the beginning of television. I can't say the beginning, but investigative reporting, because Woodward and Bernstein, you know, in 72 had uncorked Watergate with the Deep Throat. 60 Minutes had gotten into the act. Mike Wallace was making a living chasing people down the street. And this was in 78 when we did that.
Yeah, I guess you could say this was the golden age of, well, you talked about whistleblowing. There were people coming forward. There's the Pentagon Papers. And in the 1980s, actually, you went on to produce a four-part series about the history of American spy agencies from the birth of the FBI in the 1920s through the CIA's role in Iran-Contra.
Yeah, we went down to Bay of Pigs and spent some time in Cuba and followed primarily the CIA and the development. Golden Age, I refer to sort of the 90s and cable. As the golden age of documentaries, because, you know, they were calling cable units like A&E the Hitler Channel, because they were running so many World War II documentaries and newsreels. And then they discovered, more than discovered, they surmised that, look, if we produce our own documentaries, it will be a great identity for the brand, and it will be cheaper than running all these reruns. Indeed it was. It proved true. So I entered into the next 20, 25 years.
Let's go!
You're listening to the Radio Zine on KBOO. I'm S.W. Konser, and I'm talking with newscaster and documentary producer Bill Curtis. Since the 1960s, he's been producing breakthrough documentaries for CBS News, PBS, A&E, and the History Channel, among others. He also loaned his narrator voice to the film Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy. Well, you must have some opinions on the new sort of almost democratization of journalism nowadays and the new whistleblowing that's happening with outfits like WikiLeaks and Glenn Greenwald and Edward Snowden, who became a whistleblower from one of the NSA contractors.
Well, they are the perfect sources because they have primary evidence. They have taken this material and said, how do I get it out? So they go to Greenwald, and, you know, what a great paper, maybe the greatest paper.
The Guardian?
We have, yeah. And he fashioned, you know, leaking himself. They use the paper's credibility, and it all seems to be true. That's not an issue. The issue is whether he should have leaked it at all, because he was working for the government. And unfortunately, it's a self-imposed exile that he is in. I don't know whether he'll ever get out, unless he wants to come back and probably face charges or think they'll go away. You know, investigative reporting, we're just looking for the truth. The question now is, how can we keep it going when all the financing for newspapers, especially, and print, is getting smaller and smaller? There is a suggestion by a newspaper, frankly, a small one in Topeka, Kansas, and they're setting up an endowment of well-meaning community organizations and volunteers, almost like crowdsourcing, so they can pay these individuals, and then the newspaper will pick it up and be the voice.
Well, I've heard of ProPublica. Now, what's the organization you're talking about?
Well, this is a newspaper who is doing it. Okay. It's called the Topeka Capital Journal.
Oh.
And I don't know that they have a name yet for the investigation. But God knows, in Kansas, with Governor Sam Brown back, they have a lot to keep going.
Well, so many newspapers have gone to clickbait, and investigative journalism takes time, it takes resources, and it may not be the sort of thing that web viewers might immediately click on.
Yeah. You know, I was looking today in the New York Times, and they were going into some length about, and of course it escapes me now when I need it, but it was a long, long piece, in the middle, several pages, and I'm not sure that a lot of others will follow that. That's rare. I'm trying to make a point that we have leaped almost to wanting to see it as a documentary. Now documentaries are being cited as source material. Why? Well, you have to have the newsmaker on camera, and there's no getting away, I didn't say that, or misquote. They're there talking about it. They take a lot of work, a lot of money, and, skill. But there are more and more documentary makers who are working on their own. And a lot of the serious documentaries have moved to the theater.
Really?
Theatrical, yeah. Documentaries don't, and starting almost in the 80s, didn't get the ratings that the networks wanted, couldn't compare with entertainment. And they said, we're not going to stand behind, this stuff. That's just for the news division. Now, some of the weekend news on CBS, it will move over to a digital channel, CBSN, which is CBS One, the, broadband split into a variety. I do one on CBS Two, 2.2, called Decades, which is remarkable, which is an
historical document, yes.
Every day.
Right.
We didn't even know whether we could do it using the archives of CBS.
Yes. Well, you mentioned the theatrical documentaries. I mean, there are so many films out there that call themselves documentaries, but really could be considered advocacy.
Yeah.
And you're serious about not necessarily, you can't help but take a point of view, but you're serious about digging in and not starting out with an opinion, but letting things develop as you go in there. And you're not the kind of correspondent who parachutes in, lets a producer do most of the footage. You're there from the start.
Yes. The this credibility, this integrity, and journalistic training, you have to get it someplace. I got it from CBS News, and those are good rules to follow. But when you get to the theatrical releases, and it's so hard to get all the pieces together that there's a temptation to not follow the strict journalistic rules, but to follow the entertainment rules. So there are two camps where you come. And, of course, Michael Moore is something like that. Now, Michael is truthful, we hope, but he will use theatrical techniques
to
make it interesting, and they're very entertaining.
Now, one of the complaints you hear these days about television news, and you are on the CBS affiliate in Chicago, among other places, one of the complaints is that it no longer covers serious issues, at least not in depth, that it's given up its civic responsibility and is obsessed with fluff, human interest stories, and product placement and celebrity gossip. Yeah, the one news market that seems to have at least made an attempt to buck that trend is Chicago, where you and Ron Majors and Carol Marine have been longtime news anchors. Carol Marine did a bold but short-lived experiment several years ago where she returned the newscast to traditional long-form reporting and did probing interviews with local newsmakers. it didn't last, unfortunately.
No, and the pressure of making money will squeeze those pieces down to where you can hardly, you know, you need time, you need a commitment of money, you need a staff to really ferret out, you know, the topics that require investigation. It's very, very difficult to make the long slog of how politics may be involved in so many decisions that affect us and leaning toward the special interest groups. Ironically, Donald Trump, you know, gets up there and with a big mouth, you know, sort of touches on some of these things, doesn't know what he's doing, but I have heard him. I said, I wish he knew what he was doing so he could go deeper.
Well, Donald Trump doesn't know what he's not supposed to say. So he let the cat out of the bag about the missing 28 pages of the 9/11 report. And then the next thing you know, 60 Minutes is doing a report.
Oh, yeah. He's almost the National Enquirer. He's the mouthpiece. You know, the mouthpiece that just, you know, don't tell him something before he goes on because it's right there. He can't help himself. He gets in front of an audience. He knows what sells. He knows what they want. And if he would just calm down, take a Xanax, you know, before he goes on, why, he might be dangerous.
Well, these are interesting times that we live in. And I suppose the teens will be a great entry into your Decades series, one of the series that you do for cable. You know, you love doing these historical projects. And it almost seems quaint now in this era of video on demand when we can stream decades of archival news footage on our digital devices. But back in the 90s, you teamed up with author Joe Garner on one of the very first multimedia history projects, a book and DVD collection called We Interrupt This Broadcast. Walter Cronkite and Brian Williams were on board. It was a bit of a breakthrough at the time for people to have all these iconic audio and video clips available to play anytime they liked.
Yes, it was wonderful. They were the bulletins that we all know, the Hindenburg, World War II, and we had to do a second edition, you know, to come up with 9/11 and some of these things. They're very dramatic and a wonderful way to learn history. Now, what we're doing on Decades, in a show called Through the Decades, we repeat it four times on this digital channel, we have total access to the CBS archives. So we will send back a request. We'd like to do Watergate. Well, let me use another one. The JFK inaugural ball, and produced by Frank Sinatra. Well, none of us really saw it because the networks weren't carrying that. So back comes fresh video.
Wow.
Now, we've seen a little bit of Marilyn Monroe come in on the elephant and sing Happy Birthday.
Mr. President, yes.
But we didn't know that Jackie was not in attendance. And so there is a track, an interview of a guy who is saying, well, JFK was having an affair with Marilyn Monroe at the time. Jackie knew it and didn't come because she didn't want to be disrespectful. And we're saying, what?
No kidding.
Listen to that. So it's almost like discovering history all over again as you see it play out.
It's funny. With some folks, you wait long enough and they're like, oh, okay, I'll give this information up. You know, they sit on this information for so long and then you catch them at the right time.
Yeah. We found that in the Kennedy assassination. I did 5 hours starting off our investigative report series. And it was a British producer who came over and just, you know, you go out and you start interviewing people. And here's a witness and here's the guy with the photograph of the grassy knoll and the ones that the FBI has passed over and say, well, he didn't know anything. And suddenly they think, oh, my God, I'm going to die and take this secret to my grave. So now I'm going to talk. That's the secret behind Cold Case Files, too.
Uh-huh.
And when their stories now come out, you put them all together, and you have some real questions that arise. There's even one, you know, the latest is the theory that the Secret Service shot Kennedy. Now, that sounds outlandish. Until you realize the Secret Service was in a car behind the convertible, and there the Connollys and Jackie and JFK, and they had just been issued a new automatic weapon called the AR-15. It hadn't even been checked out.
Yeah,
this is which is being used today at all the mass shootings. So there was one Secret Service guy that investigative reporting has shown did little more than wash the limo in the garage and prepare it. Well, there were a number sick and probably hungover there in Dallas that day, and he was riding on top of the back seat. On the floor was the AR-15. The shot goes off from the school book depository. He allegedly goes down, grabs the rifle, pulls it up, just at as the theory goes, somebody, the driver hits the accelerator and it accidentally goes off. Well, at that's kind of logical. I mean, that's plausible. Until you realize that the bullet had to have entered the wound as a third bullet and not touch anything else. And then the bullet has to disappear. And it falls apart pretty fast. But, you know, there are people who spend lifetimes researching and writing these assassination stories. It's the great mystery.
What's the line that the dude delivers in The Big Lebowski? New shit has come to light. these days when the real news shows and the fake news shows have sort of crossed back and forth so much, it's interesting that one of the most serious people you see in Congress these days is Senator Al Franken, who used to be a Saturday Night Live writer. I was actually a crew member on his first film.
Really? Yes. Oh, my goodness. Well, I think he takes it too seriously now. I think he was so bent on changing the image, his image, of being a comedian, that he's gone too far the other way. I want to see him get a little, put a little humor in there. I think he could do well.
Well, for some of our younger listeners who may not have strong memories of a president before Barack Obama, you're not necessarily documentary producer Bill Curtis of Curtis Productions. You're more likely legendary anchorman Bill Curtis, the scorekeeper for the quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
The anchorman for Anchorman.
Right, the legend of Ron Burgundy.
Right.
You seem perfectly content to play an ironic character version of your broadcaster persona.
Yes. Oh, I love it. It's just a lot of fun. It's like a guy who retires and goes into community theater to use his talent in another way. But
well, I'm thinking of later careers of actors such as Robert Stack and Leslie Nielsen, where they were all too happy to poke fun at their tough guy image.
It's right. Well, the business deserves it. I thought, oh, well, they'll laugh me out of town. I've ruined my career. And yet every anchorman I run into wishes that they had done it. And every kid, you know, around 12 or 13 will come up and say, geez, I've seen it 13 times. And I said, well, do you mean you have heard this line 13 times? There was a time before cable, when only men read the news. And in San Diego, that man was Ron Burgundy. They know it immediately. And almost recited along with me, and I caught Will Ferrell doing the same thing because it's an iconic line that sets it up of what is to come. So I'm just having a lot of fun. I'm out of the cage. I'm no longer, you can't smile.
Well, right. You must have some great stories from all the touring you've been doing.
Yeah. Well, we've gone to a lot of cities. This is now the most popular program on NPR. And Peter Sagal, is a wonderful writer and has been with it 17 years. Wait, wait, don't tell me.
Originally a playwright.
Oh, yeah. He studied musical comedy at Harvard. And we have a wonderful staff of writers. It's just fun. Pure fun. All you have to do is worry about laughing and being funny.
As a newscaster with a legal background, I'd like to know how you feel about the scope of copyright law these days. Mm. Your colleague at CBS, Mike Wallace, produced a documentary about Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech back in 1963. And the King family estate sued CBS because they hold a copyright on the speech.
Oh, I think that's terrible because they have tried to stop or tried to collect money for the use of it in schools. I think they've made some accommodations. But when you try to, for someone, and the argument goes, someone as important as King, a piece of America, a piece of history, and you're trying to own a piece of that history, I certainly don't agree with that. Here's something else about the King family we just revealed on Decades.
Hmm.
They wanted James Earl Ray out of prison because they thought that someone else was involved, that in fact Ray did not fire the rifle that killed King, and they wanted to find out more. They worked at this and actually started a new investigation by Congress, and it went nowhere. But they they were off on a couple strange roads themselves.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's investigative reporting. I mean, sometimes you'll go down blind alleys.
Yeah, yeah. I'll just generally say that, you know, the need for investigative journalism and documentaries is greater now than it ever has been. We do a series called American Greed on CNBC. And it's about greed and how we constantly are being screwed by somebody out there trying to get our money. These are important things. It is all moving toward the iPhone, your computer at home, and, you know, the evening newscasts on network are really obsolete. CNN at least is 24 hours, but we're all going to be picking up our news on the iPhone. And for specials and documentaries, they will be in our home theaters. So it's going a little slower because there's still money to be made by the people who produce these things. But if you're making plans to invest, that's where you should keep your eye.
It does seem harder and harder for the people on the ground to make a living these days.
It does. And, we have gone from astronomical salaries to much cheaper ones. Local television, it was creeping up, but now they know, hey, there are a lot of people who really want to do this, so we're going to not pay them as much. I think the kids today are better trained, better educated as, quote, journalists. But they are not allowed. They don't have the platforms that we did. We were swashbuckling, you know. We could go out and, well, the Agent Orange, our documentary, replaced the 10 o'clock news, our big newscast.
Wow.
And 7 minutes was nothing in those days.
Back when there were three channels.
When you could, really have investigative reporting. Now you could barely get up three minutes. And I said, more talent goes into compressing news than it does in really kind of telling the whole story. But if you look and search and are really interested, you can find the source of information on the web, even visuals, you know, on YouTube. Almost anything that happens now has a video to go with it. So I think we're on the verge of wonderful things.
It's still a labor of love for so many people.
And therein lies the definition of a documentarian. You know, they say that they do the same thing that filmmakers do, but without a script. You know, it's usually a married couple, very often, that will devote 6 months to a year gathering, you know, in all seasons, the video, the visuals. At the same time, they're working other jobs to stay alive. And there are many people who are going to be watching this, but it will be played in every museum and every piece of government, and it will change laws and have an impact, and that's what you want to have as a documentarian.
The long memory.
Why will it, and why do they work so hard? Because of love, of the passion, and thank God there are still people out there like that.
Well, you've been listening to the Radio Zine on KBOO. I'm SW Conser, and I'm talking today with Peabody Award-winning newscaster and documentary producer Bill Curtis. Bill, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for dropping by.
I love it. I love it. I love your studios. I love the show. It's a pleasure to be here. And love Portland. Hey.
Yeah, have a great time while you're in Portland.
Thank you.
Thanks to Rolf Semperbond for his engineering help. And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web.
Stay classy, Portland.